Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhousecommunity.com.au.
Now to what I believe may well be one of our most significant open house discussions, incorporating all three of our open house benchmarks, life, faith and culture. It's our society's great and growing battle with the bottle. For young adults, 82% of women, 93% of young men drink at dangerous levels. Since 2000, the biggest increase in alcohol-related hospital admissions has been among 18 to 24-year-olds. They're up 130%. For young women, hospital admissions have gone up 200%. Then there's alcohol-fueled violence on the streets. Australia has a worse problem than notoriously violent cities like Los Angeles. I could go on and on about the statistics. Professor Ross Fitzgerald is one of the victims, but he also knows victory over alcohol. Yet, 44 years after going sober, he still does it one day at a time. Ross took his first drink at 14 and gave it up at 24. He drank two and four oblivion. Many times it came close to killing him. He says he was bad, mad, and dangerous to know. But then he went on to be a professor and a most prolific author and commentator, writing 36 books on history, politics, fiction. Perhaps the most important is My Name is Ross, An Alcoholic's Journey. He's also written Under the Influence, A History of Alcohol in Australia. Ross says our problem with the grog is not a sin, it's not moral, but it's a health problem. Professor Ross Fitzgerald is alive today thanks to a decades-long, often daily devotion to Alcoholics Anonymous. And at least once a day, he recites the organisation's Serenity Prayer. God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference. Professor Ross Fitzgerald has also been for many, many years a keen and astute observer and commentator on politics, especially on the Labor side. So on the day the ALP has chosen its new leader, Bill Shorten, I'm also keen to see what he thinks of that as well. Ross Fitzgerald, welcome to Open House.
Lovely to be here, Lee.
It's great to see you. Thank you so much for coming in, Ross. As I said, I think it's one of our most important discussions on Open House. To kick off the conversation, though, how do you see Bill Shorten's elevation to the Labor leadership today?
Well, it's complicated. I would have thought that Tony Abbott would much prefer Bill Shorten to be the leader of the opposition than Anthony Albanese.
Why is that?
Well, because Albanese is such a warrior in Parliament and is so persistent. But the interesting thing, of course, is that only 40% of the rank and file have voted for Bill Shorten. And that's a legacy that he'll find very difficult to overcome, I would have thought.
Will he take Labor to the next election, do you think?
Well, you can never tell. But I suppose I'd be surprised if he does, although it's difficult to change leaders under the Kevin Rudd's new ideas.
Yes. What do you think of the process, including the Labor Party membership at large in the vote? Was that a good thing, an important thing for Labor?
Oh, I think it was an important thing. But the results are rather ambiguous, aren't they? That Shorten did extremely well in caucus, but with the rank and file, he didn't do very well at all. So there's some good points and some bad points. It'll be interesting to see whether Tanya Plibersek is his deputy. I would have thought that she'd be a much stronger leader of the opposition in a few years' time than either of these two candidates.
We shall see. So now to your battle with the bottle, Ross, indeed our nation's battle with it. For you, it seems to have been genetic from reading your story.
Yeah, my father was a very tough man who played football for Collingwood, but he never drank a teaspoonful of alcohol in his entire life because his father ruined the family and the finances through his alcoholism. And I often say that my dad, Bill Fitzgerald, was an alcoholic who didn't drink. Now, Dad was not a well-educated man. As far as I know, he didn't read a book. One of his favourite songs was Snottle Durante, The Day I Read a Book, which yes, you should play sometime. But my dad knew that were he to start drinking, he'd finish up in terrible trouble. I'm the only living child. He knew that were I to start drinking, I'd end up in terrible trouble. And I found my first drink at 14. I don't regret having found alcohol at 14, because if I hadn't have found alcohol to anaesthetise the terrible feelings that I had about myself, I probably would have suicided at 17. But I can remember stumbling home when I was about 15, and my dad was about 2 o'clock in the morning, and he was waiting up for me, and he said, "What are you celebrating, son?" And I had no answer. I didn't know that I drank because I had to. And then he said, "Son, when I was your age, I lost 2 bicycles looking for my father." Now, I've never forgotten those words, but they didn't stop me drinking.
No. There was one defining event in your family which had a lot to do with your feelings about yourself and life, and that was the death of your young brother, very young brother, Rodney.
6 months old, Roddy, yes. Roddy died in my father's arms when the babe was only 6 months old, and death hovered like a miasma in our house, and that fundamentally damaged both my mother and my father. My mum was a woman who would lie when telling the truth would do. My father had a terrible nervous breakdown after the death of a child. And, of course, they were grieving for this dead brother. My mother didn't even go to the funeral. And every now and again, my mother would say, "Do you see the brightest star in all of the skies?" And she'd point up and she'd say, "That's your brother, Roddy." Well, it's very hard to compete with the brightest star in all of the skies.
Yes.
And my mum and my dad both tried to kill themselves when I was quite young. And I remember when I was about 12 or 13, my mum said, "Your dad's tried to kill himself." And I went to bed. And I used to think that I was uncaring, but I realised that's not true. It's such an overwhelming thing for a child of that age.
Yeah.
It's also fairly overwhelming not to know what's true and what's not true. So to have a mum who would lie when telling the truth would do is very, very, it's very, very difficult.
Yes.
There's a great line in the Communist Manifesto about the destruction of capitalism, and Marx and Engels writes, "All that is solid melts into the air." And my life was the opposite of that. There was no bedrock of truth to my life. So is it any wonder that honesty is tremendously important to me? Is it any wonder that apart from her being physically beautiful, the thing that attracted me and attracts me most to my wife, Lyndall, is that she's utterly honest? Also, she didn't have much time for my mum, which was a good sign in my case.
Okay. When you took that first drink at 14, where were you and what did it do to you?
I'd been to see the doctor. I was in my Melbourne High School uniform. I went into a pub about 11 o'clock and there was no alcohol in our house, but I'd heard that a brandy, lime and soda was fairly exotic, and I asked for a brandy, lime and soda, and the barman said, "I suggest you take your school cap off, son." And it was like an injection of rocket fuel. That it fundamentally changed me. What it did was to hold down the dreadful feelings that I had about myself. I mean, I was a pretty strange little boy. My idea of a good Saturday night when I was 14 or 15 would be to go to the Brighton Cemetery in Melbourne and sit in front of Adam Lindsay Gordon's obelisk and read "Life is only froth and bubble, two things stand like stone, kindness in another's trouble, courage in your own." I find it interesting now that of all of the people who were buried in the Brighton Cemetery, I wasn't attracted to Squizzy Taylor, the gangster. I wasn't attracted to Sir Thomas Bent, the Bent politician. I was attracted to an alcoholic poet who killed himself down at Park Street, Middle Brighton, where I often used to drink myself.
You drank to anaesthetise yourself and to obliterate yourself, you say.
That's right.
But it fixed nothing.
Well, I don't regret finding alcohol at 14, because if I hadn't have found alcohol at 14, I probably would have suicided at 17. But if I hadn't have stopped at 24, I wouldn't have made 25. So by the time I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, it wasn't the end of the road, it was the end of the end of the road.
Yes. What was your dad's response, Ross?
Well, my poor old dad, and to a lesser extent my mum, they suffered terribly. I left home when I was 15. I had my first sexual experience with a woman and she moved me out of home. And when you're only 15 and she's 19, it's a big difference. And my mum and dad didn't know what hit them. But eventually, after I got sent home from America, And the reason I got sent home is quite simple. If you're a non-resident in the state of Ohio and you make more than two notifiable suicide attempts, they think it's cheaper to pay your fare and send you home. Finlander, in my case, Melbourne. And I had to live. My mum and dad had to put up with me. It was a terrible thing.
You say you needed alcohol-like oxygen, and so desperate you'd secrete small bottles of gin or rum in the cistern of the toilets at university.
That was when I did the exams. You see, I topped every subject in the first 2 years at Monash University, despite my drinking. And indeed, alcohol propelled me for a while. But in those days, all that really mattered was the final exam. So I'd leave, and people commented on this, like, every hour on the hour I'd leave, and I'd go to the one cubicle, and I'd hit myself with some rum and a handful of Ritalin, they were in those days, which are rather like an amphetamine.
But again, it fixed nothing. You then went on to have a lot of shock therapy.
Yes,
What was that like?
Well, even to this day, if I'm in a room and there's flickering neon lights, I get a tremendous sense of fear and uneasiness, because I have this vestigial memory of myself out like a slab about to be wheeled in under these flickering neon lights. And nobody can be more like an object than somebody having ECT in those days. That was done without anaesthesia.
Yes.
ECT is making a bit of a comeback again. I have to say that I'm glad I don't feel resentful about having shock therapy, because I think, well, what would have I done in those days if somebody was as suicidally depressed as I was? Whether it helped or not is hard to know.
It did have quite an impact on you, though, didn't it?
Well, it had a huge impact, and a lot of my past has blacked out in the sense that I can't remember. A lot of my time at university I can't remember. For years, I was a member of the Queensland and then the New South Wales Parole Board, and there are loads of prisoners who've killed people who have absolutely no memory of doing that, and some of the board members don't believe them, but I know it's true that alcoholic amnesia is a very real part of alcoholism.
You spent every Christmas Day, apart from one, in a mental hospital.
Yeah, that was my birthday Christmas Day. From the age of 15 until I came into AA at 24, every Christmas Day I was in a mental hospital, except for my 21st birthday. And I was actually with the bloke today, Ken Gooding, my oldest friend. He was a couple of years older than me, and my mum and dad used to blame him for me going off the rails. But he held a 21st birthday party for me. I can't remember anything after 11 o'clock in the morning. I was that drunk by then. The rest of it I can't remember.
Tell us about the day and the man, Jimmy the barman, who brought you to the point of crossing the threshold into your first AA meeting.
This was in Cleveland, Ohio, and he ran a bar where the Cleveland Browns, the gridiron team, used to drink. And it was a 12 till 12 bar, but he'd always let me come in early in the morning and drink while he cleaned the place up. It actually saved my life once before in New York. And even though I was in and out of mental hospitals for alcoholism and drug addiction, and in my case the drugs were always done in the mouth, I never shot up. And I remember after the fourth hospitalisation in America, a resident said to me, "Ross, have you ever thought of going to Alcoholics Anonymous?" And I looked at this bloke and I said, "What's the point of going to AA? I can't stop drinking." So, and I remember, I used to think I was clever, that whenever I arrived somewhere, I'd find some lucky woman to look after me. They weren't Melbourne Cup winners, but they shared two things in common. They breathed in and out, and they all kicked me out. But eventually I couldn't find any woman, and I was living with this old bloke called Bill, who was a bender drinker. I remember once we cleaned our teeth and vomited almost simultaneously, and I said to him, "Mate, we've got to stop this cleaning our teeth, because every time we clean our teeth, we get crook." He was away this night, and I'd had auditory hallucinations since I was quite young. But this time, the ceiling came down and the walls moved in, and these salivating Alsatian dogs were after me. And I'm a living example. You can be drunk and terrified. And for the first time in my young life, a thought entered my head. It mightn't be a bad idea to do something about my drinking. And I went down to Jimmy's bar and I said to him, "Jimmy, I've decided to stop drinking." And he meant what he said. He said, "Fantastic news." And a half an hour later, I was back saying, "For Christ's sake, give me a drink." That's how long I lasted on my own. I only lasted a half an hour. And instead, he wrote down the number of a number and said, ring this number. And it turned out to be Alcoholics Anonymous in Cleveland, Ohio.
On Open House, we're with Professor Ross Fitzgerald. Ross, you turn up to your first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and you're given the Serenity Prayer. And that ends up meaning a lot to you.
I was given the Serenity Prayer, but I was also given an overcoat because I'd lived in America for two winters without a coat. Is it any wonder that I have a great deal of arthritis? I got involved in a suicide pact when I was about 18 and drove a car off the Camden Bridge, and I was in hospital for a long time, and indeed my left leg is 1 inch shorter than my right leg. But I was also given the Serenity Prayer. Because I'm an atheist, and I was a very rigorous atheist, I couldn't say the word God. So what I used to do was to say, please grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. These days, I say, please God grant me. There's something very special about that Serenity Prayer. It's a shorter version of a prayer by Reinhold Niebuhr, the Protestant theologian. But there's something about that prayer that speaks very deeply to alcoholics and to other addicts. And I certainly say the Serenity Prayer at least once a day as a mantra. But think about it. To think, well, what are the things that I can change? What are the things that I need to accept? And how do I know the difference between what I need to change and what I need to accept each day?
You were particularly struck by the welcome and the kindness of AA. Mm.
Sorry, I get...
No, that's quite understandable.
Well, for someone like me, you know, who, as I said, I was like Lord Byron. I was bad, mad and dangerous to know. I wasn't the sort of person you invited anywhere. And I don't know why this connects so deeply with me. I suppose the sort of welcome that people didn't care what I'd done. And I was absolutely amazed that men and women would talk about doing these things that I thought nobody else did. And for the first time in my life, I felt that I belonged somewhere. And that welcoming is very seductive. And my sponsor in AA in Melbourne, after I got sent home from Cleveland, he did something that had never happened in my life. He never criticised me. Never criticised me once.
You went to AA meetings every night for 5 years.
I only became sober when I stopped not just drinking but using all other drugs as well.
Yeah.
Because I was so damaged. I was damaged not just by alcohol and drugs, and towards my method of forging prescriptions in America would be to get a prescription for, say, 50 Seconal and add a naught. They must have known that they were forged. I was drinking all the time, taking something like 20 or 30 barbiturates a day. There's a line in the big book called Alcoholics Anonymous that says, a mind that's been badly battered and a body that's been badly burnt does not heal overnight. Well, that's no understatement.
No.
And it took a long time. It took a long time before I could do anything, really.
Can you lift the veil for us on what goes on at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and why it's been so successful doing what it does?
Well, it's so successful because it's a lay group whose only interest is in helping themselves and other people to get sober. And the structure of AA is very important. The meetings start on time and finish on time. And within that structure, rather like classical psychoanalysis, within that structure, sober alcoholics talk about what we used to be like, what happened and what we're like now. And it's pointed out at every AA meeting, or almost every AA meeting, that alcoholism isn't a moral problem, it's a health problem. That alcoholics aren't bad people who need to get good. Alcoholics are sick human beings who can recover a day at a time if they don't pick up that first drink of alcohol and they keep coming to the meetings. So AA has done for me what's something that all the money in this big city couldn't buy. It's enabled me to live my life without needing to use alcohol without needing to use other drugs and without seriously thinking about killing myself.
It's important to say that even with the help of AA, it's not an immediate turnaround, and it is likely to take years and years, and in a way it still is a battle day by day.
Well, a battle's perhaps the wrong word. My dear friend Broken Hill Jack, his sponsor was Bobby Delaney, the Australian light heavyweight boxing champion. And Delaney used to say, "I'm not a retired alcoholic, I'm a defeated one." And I like that way of putting it. I'm not punching on against the booze or other drugs. I have surrendered. But I need to surrender every day. And were I to stop going to AA consciously, even for a week or two, that would be a symbol that I'm doing this on my own. But I'm not doing this on my own. The isolated exercise of the will is useless when it comes to alcoholism. It's useless when it comes to diabetes or cancer. Although I'm an atheist, I'm not sober because of my own strength or cleverness. I'm only sober because I surrender day after day after day. One of the things that Alcoholics Anonymous does for me is I feel useful there. And I tell you what, when I was on the booze and in all those mental hospitals, useful I was not. Because despite what people might think of me, and we don't like each other in AA all the time, I'm a fantastic example of what AA can do to someone who is so damaged.
So it's helped you give up the grog. But how do you explain how that has happened? How have you been able to get over that fearsome addiction?
Well, I think it's a line from Kierkegaard that says, "Purity of mind is the capacity to will one thing." And at the meetings of AA, the men and women that are there, and some are as young as 16, and some are as old as 90, but we're all there for the one reason. We're all there because we need help in order not to drink. And I'm so grateful that I became sort of receptive to surviving. And I'm glad that I believed people like Broken Hill Jack and Steve from Gordon, who said, "Friends, if any of us pick up a drink today, we may never be receptive again." And I've seen that happen so many times. I mean, AA's got the numbers, but it's a very difficult business for an alcoholic man or woman to get sober and to stay sober and to use that peculiar phrase, to negotiate the world with nothing in our blood but blood.
I love the names. You just mentioned a couple of them, the names that people acquire or are given. I've got Cast Iron Kate, Raucous Dick, Under the Stars Len, Ukulele Jimmy, Incinerator Herbie, Circus Lil. Talk to us about the camaraderie of AA.
And there's another one, Antique Harry, because he used to make antique furniture, which my Balinese friends find very humorous. I'd made up my mind when I was a little boy that no way does anybody ever get close to me. And life was like that. And up to now, my last hospitalisation was in a mental hospital in Melbourne called Delmont. And the day before I was due to be released, we got taken to an AA meeting at the Malvern Town Hall. And I came up to Antique Harry after the meeting and I was almost in tears. And I said, "Harry, do you ever think I'll get this thing?" And instead of saying "no hope unless you get off the tablets," which is true, but not very useful, Antique Harry said to me, "Son, if you stay close to this movement, you'll be all right." Now, I've got a big Adam's apple. Those words connected with my heart. And as damaged as I was, I knew he couldn't have had faith in me. How could he? What he had faith in was the movement of Alcoholics Anonymous, with people talking about what they used to be like, what happened and what they're like now, which... Again, I'm an atheist, but I got released.
Yes.
Somehow I got released from the need to drink alcohol and I got released from the need to drink other drugs. And I've only been sober, and it'll be 44, if I survive and don't drink, it'll be 44 years on Australia Day. I'm only sober, free not just of alcohol, but all other drugs as well.
People in the movement who believe in God call this a miracle.
Absolutely. And I can understand what they mean. I find it absolutely extraordinary that somebody can go into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and the meetings might last an hour or an hour and a half and never drink again. That didn't happen to me, but it happens to lots of people that and Christians, religious people would call that miraculous. It goes against the order of nature because the most natural thing for an alcoholic man or woman to do is to drink alcohol. What is interesting and fascinating is alcoholics who don't need to drink. And AA, as I said, has got the numbers. I often say, you know, that AA is by far the most successful agency in helping alcoholics to stop drinking. So why don't you avail yourself of the best? And a lot of people have ideas about AA that are just not true. A lot of them think you've got to believe in God. We jokingly say there are three sorts of people in AA: those that believe in God, those that don't believe in God, and those that think they are God. So there's room for us all. Believe it or not, I taught biblical studies. I can't go into that.
Yes, I know that. Yeah, yes, I know.
And one of my favourite lines is, "The Lord's house has many mansions." I think that's right. There's room for us all. There's room for us all in AA.
There's a very strong thread of people with faith, people of Christian faith, the Serenity Prayer, that is both part of AA and also part of your life,
yeah,
though an avowed atheist.
The word confident enthusiasm, I think confidence comes from confideo, meaning with faith, and entheo, in God. So in a way it's... Yeah. But God is often the word for the word that you can't say. What AA says is we believe in a power greater than ourselves, and of course AA is a power greater than myself, or we believe in God as we understand him or her, or we don't.
Does a person's problem with alcohol need to be a raging, life-threatening thing for them to get help through AA? What about those for whom alcohol plays a quiet, though significant part in their life, who remain pretty functional in life?
I topped every subject in the first 2 years. I got a master's degree at the depths of my drinking in Cleveland. If you think you're an alcoholic, ask yourself three questions. Is alcohol costing you more than money? 2, after having drunk alcohol, can you not guarantee your behaviour with some sort of safety? And 3, as a result of drinking alcohol, do you behave in ways that make yourself feel ashamed? I do think, though, there's a difference between a heavy drinker and an alcoholic. Heavy drinkers tend not to suffer from alcoholic amnesia, and heavy drinkers tend not to have that violent change in personality. They tend not to be full of murderous rage like I was. Yeah. And the rage, in my case, was undifferentiated. It was directed outside of myself, but it was directed to myself as well.
You've written My Name is Ross, An Alcoholic's Journey. To be of use, that's been very important for you, for something good to come out of such a tough journey.
Yeah, I mean, what happened was I got diagnosed, I was bleeding from the brain in 4 places. And I thought to myself, well, I think it would be helpful to write down my alcoholic story in the hope that I can be useful to others. Some people don't think it's a very good idea that I've done that. But in the main, My Name is Ross has been a big help to a lot of people.
What would your message be tonight to anyone who's listening, who in the quietness of their own mind recognise and acknowledge that they have this problem with alcohol? What would you say to them?
I'd say, do you want to stop drinking? And if you want to stop drinking, well, I suggest that you go to a few meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if after a few weeks you don't like what you've got, well, your misery can be refunded. Just look up Alcoholics Anonymous in the local phone book. There are meetings of AA. There are thousands of meetings of AA throughout the length and breadth of Australia, not just in cities, but in most major country towns.
What would you say after this lifetime journey about gratitude, about where you are now and what you've done since you've been saved from alcohol?
Well, Brackenhill Jack used to say to me, "Have you been counting your blessings, son?" And for a while I couldn't do that. But these days I count my blessings one by one. My father's favourite singer was Joseph Locke, and his favourite song and my favourite song is "Count Your Blessings One by One." Sometime you might play that. It's an absolutely wonderful
song. Yes.
So I'm extremely lucky, but I need to be vigilant. I need to realise that I'm as vulnerable as anyone else, and that unless I keep doing what I have been doing, unless I surrender, unless I keep going to the meetings of AA, I may well end up drinking again. So I haven't got it by the short and curlies, as some people say.
It's an epic story and a vitally important, significant story for Australia and the world, for that matter. Ross Fitzgerald, I'm so glad you've joined us. Thank you so much indeed for joining us.
Thanks, Lee.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. To hear more from Open House, visit openhousecommunity.com.au.